Today we wrap up Season 7 of the Soil Sense podcast with a well-known and well-respected farmer and longtime soil conservationist, Barry Fisher.
If you really think about our plants, our current crops are only feeding the biology June, July, and a little bit of May, and maybe a little bit of August. So that's a very small percent of the total year. So if we can get a cover crop, that's what was huge when we started down the road. We did a lot of talking about no-till as far as protecting the soil from erosion. But when we added cover crops to it, that was a game changer in that now the cover crop immediately fed more biology longer. That biology immediately started providing aggregate stability, which absolutely helps the surface infiltration of soil, the aeration of soil, you know, start getting better structure to the surface of the soil. And that can happen in as little as one season when we add cover crops.
Barry Fisher discusses soil health principles, important considerations for transition to regenerative practices, the essential role of a knowledgeable advisor, and so much more. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning into Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down with farmer, soil health consultant, and longtime soil conservationist, Barry Fisher. Barry is retired from his career at the USDA, where he most recently worked in the soil health division. In that capacity, he met with and spoke with farmers about soil health throughout the central part of the U.S. Since retirement, he manages his family farm in Greencastle, Indiana, in the west central part of the state, and has a consulting business where he does training and soil health education for organizations through Fisher Soil Health. This was a fantastic conversation where we really get to clarify a lot of the principles that we've discussed throughout this entire season. Barry eloquently describes the science of what's happening when we build healthier soils and the functions that farmers get from these soils as a result of these practices. We also dive into what it looks like to transition into some of these practices if you're maybe starting from scratch. So much here for the beginner and the well-experienced expert as well. First, I asked Barry to explain what he calls the fence row effect, which is a great way to dive into some of the important principles of soil health.
Yeah, that was kind of a visual that I knew a lot of farmers would identify with because they've all got yield monitors on their combines, and they see these anomalies out across the landscape. They're going through their field and they're watching the yield, and then there's all of a sudden this pow, their yield just goes through the roof in this one spot. And if they look back on the map, that's where an old fence row used to be. In other words, I use it to kind of validate the four principles of soil health, reduce disturbance to the soil as much as possible, add diversity as much as possible, keep the soil covered and protected as much as possible, and keep a living root growing in the ground as much as possible. And those are kind of our four soil health principles that we spend a lot of time on. And you think back when I talk to the farmers who are familiar with this anomaly, I use that fence row. I said, well, if that was a fence row in recent past, think about that fence row. Did it have much disturbance? Did it have continuous living roots? Did it have some diversity? And was it covered nearly 365 days a year? Yes, it was. And see, soil health and these principles can lead to high production and essentially good resilience during all kinds of weather extremes and things like that. And it kind of gets their attention, but it's real too. You know, it's absolutely real. So there's good organic matter that has been stored in that old fence row. It could be an old fence row, it could be an old pasture. It's not an area that necessarily received higher fertility or higher attention, management attention. It just had those four principles in place. And so it had good buildup of good organic matter and a good ecology living below the soil surface. It's a way to get started in the conversation so we're on the same page that we're not really, when we talk about soil health, we're not talking about just foo-foo. It's real. It's real production potential and production resilience.
I'm curious, as you start the conversation that way, then what pathways does it take, or what kind of follow-up questions do you get to that kind of visualization of soil health?
Well, generally there's some farmer in the front row that says, okay, Fisher, that's great, but my landlord wants me to farm the whole farm, not just the old fence rows. So it opens the door. Okay, well, how can we manage for that effect across the whole farm? And so then I usually have follow-up pictures or photos of, here's this farm that just by chance adopted these practices or this system that mimics that fence row effect that gets those four principles in place. And I'll show them some aerial photos or something in a difficult year. Like, you know, most farmers around know, oh, that was that bad year, that was that wet year, that was that really dry year. And if I can show those aerial photos where management on one farm had the four principles kind of in place and the management on the farm right next to it did not, and the aerial photo is very telling that, yes, we can manage beyond the fence row. We can get that fence row effect across the entire farm. And so, but yeah, those are the kind of the questions that come out. And of course, if you get them interested, at least at that point, then you start talking practical strategies. And depending on where you're at in the country, that strategy or that entry point may be something different to look at. But there's always a starting place that makes the most logical sense from a scientific standpoint and an economic standpoint. So we try to look for that.
Yeah, and I want to get into some of those strategies for sure. But before we do, I want to talk about yield, because on one hand, you're kind of pointing out that, hey, these fence row areas where the principles are followed, you know, you see that bump in yield. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have people saying like, yeah, I don't do any of these practices, but I get good yields. So doesn't that mean I have good soil health?
What it means is we've got fantastic technology and genetics in this country. That's what that means. And we've been able to mask some loss in that soil function, the natural soil functions. We've been able to compensate for that through some fantastic tools, the fantastic technologies, products, and genetics. And so, yes, and that's why probably that's the one that, you know, there's a lot of farmers that, you know, to an outsider, they look at this and say, well, why isn't every farmer doing this? Well, they're not doing it because they don't have to, for one, because they have all this technology and tools in place that help them get those good yields and help the land that they've got. So they might not see the need to change. As human beings, we really don't like change very much. You know, it takes not just some charts and graphs in a PowerPoint presentation to get you to change. It's going to have to be something else that you can see really solves another problem. And now that water is coming very rapidly or not at all in the way of our weather extremes, then farmers are seeing that they need to, even on those really good farms that are getting good yields, they still see times when it's going to really benefit me if I could get some better infiltration, if I didn't have any ponding, if I could hold water a little longer into the season. And most of the time you can tie that back to a system that builds organic matter and builds that soil function, like that fence row, is going to be beneficial no matter how good your land is.
Right. And if you talk to somebody who's, all right, he's always had good yields and hits one of those years where, whoa, my neighbor really handled this tough year a lot better than I did, whether that's too much moisture or not enough moisture. And they've been kind of long-term no-till cover crops. And okay, now I'm seeing the difference. I'm starting to see the light here. Where do you start with someone like that? It's like, okay, where's a quick win I can get, or how do I make this transition? Because I can't fast forward a decade and get to where they are. You know, where do I start?
Yeah, and that's where we have to decide. You know, you can talk at a conference or someplace about general step-in strategies and what would be maybe for this general area where we know mostly corn and soybeans are going to be the crop rotation, where might be your best step-in? And we talk a lot of times about, you know, after corn, believe it or not, going to soybeans is one of the best places to get like a cereal rye cover crop started, because then soybeans are very adapted to that environment, and I can no-till soybeans into that rye cover crop very successfully. I immediately get the benefits of added weed control, better weed control, better moisture conservation, all those kinds of things. I can get benefits pretty quickly there. We try to find a step in, where's the most logical step in place? And that, for a lot of farmers here in the Midwest, that's a good step in place. But even there, it really gets down to an understanding of that individual's management style. What's their equipment look like? How have they operated in the past? So you can't just, you know, with a broad brush say, here's how you need to do it. Here's how everybody in the room needs to do it. That's why we spend a lot of time with other ag professionals that do more one-on-one work, so they can read that farmer, know that farmer, know specifically where their best step in to this system is, and provide a custom plan and strategy for them to do that. So that, you know, today we know enough. We don't expect a yield loss from stepping into a conservation agriculture or a soil health management system. We don't feel like we have to have this yield drag that has been talked about in years. I think we know enough how to avoid that, but that doesn't mean that those who try it without some of the knowing the nuances of how to manage this system, I mean, it's not impossible for them to have a yield problem if they don't understand some of the little nuances that aren't very intuitive as you make some of these shifts. So that's why we still do the conferences and the workshops with a lot of those folks.
Yeah. What's your take on the status of people that are working in that advisory role? Do you feel like there's an interest, or do you feel like there's, you know, do you know what they need to be able to help farmers step into these practices?
Yes. There's a gap. I will be honest, especially here in the Midwest, there is a knowledge gap, because as an agronomist, we spend a lot of our time finding a product to solve a problem, you know, rather than a management strategy. And so if that's been our focus for most of our career, and then somebody comes along and says, well, we've got this other system of practices that might help solve some problems and stuff that's totally different than anything you've been doing, your first inclination is to say, wait a minute, you know, that could be a problem. That's not necessarily what I've been working with. I don't have a comfort level there. And the last thing I want for my client is a train wreck. So we have to spend a lot of time with them. First of all, giving them a background and understanding that now we're looking at a biologically driven system, and we have to manage for a living ecosystem if we're going to regenerate some of these soil functions. And that means we have to have an understanding of the biology that maybe we never had to have before. And so when we spend time with some of those ag professionals in some advanced soil health training classes, we spend the first session or two giving them kind of some foundation in soil biology. You know, we have to understand how those functional groups of biota, how they carry out different functions in the soil, and how our management can affect their habitat and those kinds of things. So there's a knowledge gap there, but I'm always amazed at, I may have a room full of people who are, you know, ag retail people, that's what they do. And they're pretty immediately interested in this whole conservation farming or sustainable farming, or, you know, they might be a little afraid of certain stigmas or words or things like that. But when we start off, you know, talking about a fence row effect, showing them real functional gains that can be made in soil for their customers, I'm amazed how quickly they really join the conversation and ask a lot of questions, and their interest is pretty great, really. I'm kind of amazed at that, to be honest.
That's really cool. And as you're helping them and helping farmers, so in turn, them helping farmers, talk about this transition of kind of starting to boost this biology as you're making this transition. I know you've talked about starter fertilizers and why it's important to sort of get that early season nutrition there. Can you just talk about that and the transition of why that's so important?
I think what maybe agronomists and farmers either forget or don't spend a lot of time on is in a conventional, like a full width tillage system, that tillage system, like that last pass in the spring of the year, is a fertilizer delivery system. In other words, as we stir the soil and make available new pieces of carbon and organic matter for the bacteria and the fungi and everything to eat and live off of, the respiration in the soil, we've got an absolute undeniable evidence that the respiration explodes. So that means the CO2 is what we're measuring. So if the CO2 is leaving, that's carbon leaving. So it is at the expense of carbon out of our soil. So it is burning off. But that operation gave us a flush of plant available nutrients from that tillage operation. Okay. And also, most of the genetics that we've selected for over the years, guess what? It came out of that system. So if one day we decide we're going to stop tilling the soil, and oh, maybe we're going to add a cover crop that's using nutrients till early in the spring, if we're going to change to that system, then we have to understand that that early delivery of nutrients that came from the tillage, that came from the loss of organic matter, but it did deliver us a lot of nutrients early in the season, that now we don't have that. And so if we're going to make that transition, especially early in the transition period, a first year or two, it's even more pronounced, then an early delivery of, say, starter fertilizer, especially something with nitrogen and sulfur, at that early growth stage of the corn, when it's determining its ear size, it's setting its ear, it's setting the stage for the rest of the year, its genetic background says, hey, I should have this big flush of nutrients that came from tillage, but now I don't. So I have to provide starter fertilizer early on to balance that early fertility flush that was going to be gained in tillage, but now it's not. Now, the beauty is all of that nutrient cycling that happens by the biology is going to happen later in the season. We're going to have more of that cycling happen throughout the rest of the season if we can get past that early stage. And there was a scientist at the Ag Research Service in Ames, Iowa. His name was Dr. Dean Martins, not Dean Martin that had the martini glass on TV for you older folks out there. But Dr. Dean Martins, he did a revolutionary study where he was trying to figure this whole thing out. And he was one of the first ones that really the light bulb came on for me that showed what a huge part of the overall delivery came from the soil and the biology in the soil. And when we switched to no-till, how important it was to provide early nitrogen. And he even narrowed it down to early nitrate nitrogen was even more beneficial because it wasn't something that all of that hungry biology in the soil was used to having. So it gave the young corn plant more of a competitive edge at that nitrate nitrogen, which is kind of counterintuitive to a lot of people's understanding of what sources of nitrogen corn prefers. But in that early situation, in the transition from tillage to no-till, Dr. Martins really was able to uncover that we needed, 35 to 40 units of available nitrate nitrogen to provide that young corn plant what it needs to build protein and do whatever it needs to set that early ear size. So that was revolutionary, but that happened in the 90s. But I think still some of that information, Dr. Martins died at early death, unfortunately, to the science community, because he was really on the cusp of some great work. But I still keep those old paper copies of his research because it still holds true today. And a lot of farmers don't understand that importance as they make the transition.
Well, along similar lines, as I reflect on the season so far, you know, we've talked a lot about protecting the soil, right? So like keeping the cover crop on to protect against things like erosion. What we haven't talked as much about is sort of this other side of the principles, which is feeding the soil. You know, I know we're talking about kind of giving the crops a jumpstart through things like starter fertilizer or micronutrients, but what about feeding that biology to try to get it up to its potential as soon as possible? Is there anything going on there that we should be talking about?
Oh, yeah. And that's why when we talk about those four principles, continuous living roots is in there, because the biology in the soil is fed primarily by a living root and the root exudates that come out through the photosynthesis process. You know, most plants, especially in their early growth stages, they're in a recruitment program. You know, they're actually leaking out a lot of the very sugars that they're making out of photosynthesis from the free sunlight energy and the CO2. They're making these really nice compounds, but they're giving away early on a considerable amount. Up to half of those get leaked out to the surrounding area around the rhizosphere, around the root. So that's a recruitment mechanism. They're providing the carbon and the energy to those so that those organisms then throughout the season will provide back to the plant some of the needed micronutrients and compounds that benefit that plant, and even disease suppression we're learning today. So the continuous living root part of the cover crop is often overlooked. Just think about, you know, a corn plant in a corn bean rotation. You know, we seed it sometime in May, it kind of starts getting a good enough root system that it's probably feeding organisms itself through the end of May, the 1st of June, the last, really the whole month of June. But by the end of July, we've gone to a reproductive phase where most plants stop that sharing of resources because they're done recruiting. And now it's time to make sure I finish my reproductive process. And so if you really think about our plants, our current crops are only feeding the biology, you know, June, July, and a little bit of May, and maybe a little bit of August. So that's a very small percent of the total year. So if we can get a cover crop, that's what was huge when we started down the road. We did a lot of talking about no-till as far as protecting the soil from erosion. But when we added cover crops to it, that was a game changer in that now the cover crop immediately fed more biology longer. That biology immediately started providing aggregate stability, which absolutely helps the surface infiltration of soil, the aeration of soil, you know, start getting better structure to the surface of the soil. And that can happen in as little as one season when we add cover crops. And so the immediate benefit from that living root feeding the biology in the soil, the carbon that it needs for energy, all those organisms, they really need the carbon for energy, and the only way they can get it is through a plant and through those root exudates. So that does not get talked about very much, but it is huge in establishing a strategy to truly improve soil function as early in the process as possible.
And along similar lines, should we be considering that when we come up with a cover crop mix of at what stage is that particular species going to, you know, recruit the microbes, for lack of a better term? Or are they pretty much all recruiting at the same time?
Well, they put out different compounds. It's why we always talk about, hey, anytime we can have a window of opportunity to get a diverse cover crop, let's do it. Because we know that different plants provide different root exudates that are beneficial to different functional microbes and different functional groups in the soil of the biology that lives in the soil. So that's why when farmers talk about a cocktail mix of cover crops really being beneficial, or they see that benefit immediately the very next year, it's probably why, is because we've fed such a diverse group of organisms below ground, you know, and fed different functional groups that provide a more balanced ecosystem that ultimately has so many benefits to that ultimate crop that follows that system. So we don't always have, in our corn soybean world, we don't always have a good window to get a very diverse cover crop mix, but we always try to get at least two or three functional groups. In other words, a cool season grass and a cool season broadleaf. And maybe we can possibly get a legume in there that all do three kind of different things for us and feed different groups of organisms below the ground and provide different rooting structures, and just the sheer architecture of their roots is better too. So anytime we can get a diverse mix of cover crops, we try to, but we're practical enough to say, hey, don't waste money on something that has no chance. Make sure your window of opportunity, you have enough time to get growth, or don't spend that money. Just, you know, that's why so many situations in corn bean world, we default back to something like cereal rye after corn because it's so hardy through the winter months and can still survive the winter and still gives us a growing root that's going to be beneficial to the overall system.
I like that, the way you broke that down into these kind of functional groups for cover crops and how you select and mix. And then you also referred to kind of the rooting structure. And I remember that being a big barrier when I started using cover crops or advising growers on it. Do you have any other bits of wisdom that can kind of fit in there for getting started with cover crops and picking your mix or how to do that effectively?
One strategy that I talk to farmers about is that, hey, you're making this transition. Let's find a field or let's look for a place where most farmers will plant different maturity groups of soybeans, for example. And that just helps them with harvest. Like right now, the farmers in my neighborhood, we're harvesting some of those late group two soybeans. That's a maturity group. And here it is, it's September, right? So if those beans can come off in September, it helps us with harvest. We've gotten better at selecting some of those earlier groups that still yield quite well, but really helps us spread our workload out through the fall. Then that also gives us an opportunity, like right now, if I can follow that combine that's combining soybeans out there, I can put together a 4 or 5 way mix at least of cover crops that have a very good chance of getting off to a good start and making it into the winter, giving me enough growth before winter sets in, and probably then has enough root structure to survive the winter and take off early in the spring. So if I can find that kind of a strategy, if I can plan a year in advance or a season in advance for that kind of a scenario, I also talked to farmers and said, you know, a lot of guys in our area, they don't plant wheat a lot. But if you've got a field, if you're wanting to start in this system, if you can rotate wheat through your acres, that wheat gives you a window of opportunity. Now I can put an 8, 10, 9, 10 way mix of cover crops that really meet all those functional demands. And I will just tell you, any place that we can get that done here in the Midwest, and then our next crop be corn following that 12-way mix of cover crops that went after wheat, we'll see yield gains for multiple years thereafter that have benefited from that really fast startup of building soil function from just growing wheat 1 year in my rotation in that particular part that just really then sets that field off on the right path as far as from a functional standpoint. Not to mention it gives me a window. I can grow some nitrogen during that window too. That's, you know, very expensive nitrogen. I can grow some organic nitrogen in that window that ultimately helps that corn crop next too.
I want to ask you, I notice you keep saying soil function. Do you prefer the term soil function to soil health, or are you using them interchangeably?
It takes soil health to acquire the soil functions that farmers want and identify with. You have to have the health. It's the health that gives you better infiltration, better water holding capacity, better nutrient cycling, better air movement and oxygen. And I can go on and on about what are the functions, but those are the functions that farmers identify with. But it takes soil health and soil health management to achieve those soil functions.
Yeah, and I know certainly part of the challenge here is we talk to so many farmers that are at varying stages of their soil health journey, as we'd call it. You know, a lot of them are wrestling with this mindset shift of like, how do I plan for something so variable, right? Whereas it's not a prescription. It's not something where I just can dial in what I'm going to do this year and do it. It's something where I have to adjust to what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing. How do you help farmers and then also people who advise farmers to think about planning in such a variable and dynamic setting?
Well, that may very well be the greatest challenge that prevents broad adoption at this point in time. I think technology is really on our side here. Both information technology, communication technology, and the digital technology that's at their fingertips, where they can make game time decisions more confidently based on, I've got a moisture sensor out there in my field that I can check the data on. I have my yield maps. I know where different things happen at different times. I've got temperature sensors. I can check conductivity. I can do so many things that help me make wise decisions in a game time situation. And so I think that will help a lot. And then the beauty is, that same kind of technology is now being beamed up to their crop advisor. Their crop advisor knows this same kind of thing. They've got multiple customers around that are trying to manage the same scenario. So they can say, hey, soil's getting a little dry out there. The long-term forecast is not a lot of rain in the forecast. You better go terminate that cover crop. And as farmers are communicating with other farmers and all this kind of stuff. So we have to learn how to not make every decision independently. We need to use the resources at hand and use the kind of the crowdsourcing to help us with management decisions. And I think farmers are getting better at that than they used to be. I mean, harvest has started, and I'd hate to think how many texts I've received today, what guys are seeing, what they're seeing on yield, and what they're sending pictures of, what are you planting in the way of cover crops? And so just as simple as the text on the phone and the you know, Facebook pages and things like that, guys are crowdsourcing their information very effectively, and that leads to good sound management decisions in a very dynamic world. So I don't know if that answered your question or not, but that unsurety, that dynamic nature of managing this biological system is probably the most frightening if you're a very pragmatic decision maker, especially. So.
Well, you and Abby could have a very long conversation about the work she's been doing in North Dakota with the Trusted Advisor Partnership, and sounds like the work you're doing there. And I'm sure you guys should compare notes later on that. But before we go here, I know we've only scratched the surface on your extensive knowledge of this stuff, Barry, but I just want to give you one final chance for a message. Sometimes we say this, we frame this as your TED Talk to the industry. You know, farmers listening that are at differing points on their soil health journey, what message would you want to leave them with?
Well, I want farmers to understand that when you read an article in the news magazine, in your farm magazine or whatever, if you hear the term soil health, that it's not just something that is a feel-good thing or it's something that's passing. It's a management strategy where you truly can improve the soil functions that provide productivity, provide efficiency, sustain yields through different crazy weather, and it gives you a resiliency that you're going to need down the road. And even if you historically have some of the best farmland in the country, most of that farmland, we've lost over half of our organic matter that was there, you know, when we first broke that land out. So most of us know and understand the importance of organic matter. If we go to an auction, the land with the highest organic matter sells for the highest dollar. We've got to get back to a system where we're building organic matter and we're not losing organic matter, because it's that organic matter, that carbon in the soil, that is so beneficial from a water holding standpoint, from an infiltration standpoint, from a nutrient cycling standpoint, all the things that ultimately provide yield and provide efficiency, a main part of your bottom line, your return on investment. So while many of us are getting good yields today, we have to look beyond and make absolutely sure that as weather gets a little crazier, and it's probably going to, we've got to have a very, very resilient system. And we've got to be able to get those yields as efficiently as possible. And that efficiency comes from a highly functioning soil. And that highly functioning soil is achieved through good, sound soil health management.
Wow, what a wonderful way to end not only this episode, but this season of Soil Sense. Thank you so very much to Barry Fisher for being on the show. He really does speak so clearly about these topics and ties together much of what we've shared over these past 24 episodes. Thank you, Barry, for sharing your years of knowledge and wisdom here on this podcast. Before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow the show on your favorite podcast app, and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Well, this wraps up season 7 of Soil Sense. So until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.